what can you say? Here in Vancouver or here in British Columbia, we save our riding for really important things like the home team losing the Stanley Cup.
I got back into politics because I wanted to make government, I wanted to make the province better for British
tar
Columbia.
Tar sands is not conventional oil. It's dirtier, it's riskier, and it's more expensive.
You got a business. That you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
Moody's downgraded the credit rating of the international banks because it said they are vulnerable to unstable markets and risk failing.
I don't know why the stock market is where it is when you have so many people out of work and so many problems in the country.
Some of the stories of this year from Canada, from the economy, as we take a look back on 2012 and get ready to say goodbye to it. Vaughn Palmer is saying goodbye to 2012 by talking to his and listening to his Canadian citizen friends as they get ready to shop. Right, Vaughn? Boxing Day.
Oh, they've been going at it now, Steve, for 10 hours. People have been lining up for the big shopping day of the year. They've been outside stores bargain hunting. And now that most of the stores are open, the places are jammed with Canadians looking for Boxing Day bargains.
Now, has Boxing Day always been a retail holiday?
No, I think it's with the rise of, well, I hate, forgive the pun, big box retailing, but no, it's something that's taken on. It's been a statutory holiday in parts of Canada for a long time. It's a holiday here in British Columbia, for instance, and most other Canadian provinces. But the rise of day after Christmas bargain shopping is probably modern times, the rise of consumer society and all that sort of thing.
What is Boxing Day originally? What was it?
Damned if I know. That's actually the honest thing. People, look it up on Wikipedia. It's got the leading theory. It's a British tradition that dates back as far as the Middle Ages, and the reigning theory is that it was the day after Christmas when servants and tradespeople would receive gifts from their superiors or their employers or the estate keeper, a Christmas box, and essentially it was presents for the working people, the working class. It is still there as a day, and it's called it, and that's where the box supposedly comes from. But, you know, there were Christmas boxes given away to the poor. What is it? According to the Wikipedia entry, the tradition of Christmas boxes of money and presents being given on the first weekday after Christmas as thanks for good service through the year is mentioned in Samuel Pepys's diary, December 19th, 1663. So there you go. So it's been around for a while.
Yeah,
as I say, it's a statutory holiday in a lot of places, giving us really 2 days for Christmas. And then, you know, the modern society having turned everything into an excuse for shopping, it is now a huge shopping day as well, a little like Black Friday in the United States. And by the way, there are signs we're picking that tradition up as well. So we've got lots of shopping days.
Wait, after our Thanksgiving, you're having a big retail day?
Oh, yeah, and Cyber Monday, you know, there's a big debate going on right now and among shoppers as to whether or not the bargains are as good as they used to be on Boxing Day, or whether or not Canadian retailers, particularly the online ones, being more in tune with the American market, are actually got better bargains on Black Friday or Cyber Monday.
That's hilarious, Vaughn, that just shows how intertwined we are. I am struck by, so this is the first day of Kwanzaa in the U.S. It falls on December 26th. In Germany, Poland, Scandinavia, and Netherlands, December 26th is celebrated as Second Christmas Day, which is interesting. In South Africa, they renamed it the Day of Goodwill in 1994. In Ireland, St. Stephen's Day. But in the U.K., Hong Kong, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, a few other Commonwealth nations, It's a national or a regional holiday.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
I think we need to adopt it.
Well, you know, the more holidays, the better, I guess.
I agree.
Not sure our employers would say that. I don't know who would be doing any work. But, yeah, it's a big statutory holiday. And if Christmas is on a Saturday, for instance, so, you know, that bumps into the next week, and you get since most people have the weekend off anyway, you get two substitute holidays on the Monday and the Tuesday.
Excellent. I think that's excellent. All right, let's box up some of the big news stories of this year. And let's start with this controversy.
Yeah.
Canada's Newsmaker of the Year. Time magazine, they chose President Obama as their person of the year. Who's Canada's Newsmaker of the Year?
Well, there's a big debate about that. The Canadian Press, our equivalent of the Associated Press, polls news editors across the country every year and asks them who is the Newsmaker of the Year. And it's not considered an honor. It's not the most likable person of the year. It's what was the person at the center of the big story. And this year's choice was Luca Rocco Magnotta, who is an accused killer of a Chinese engineering student. He basically kidnapped the guy, cut him up, and mailed his body parts to four different locations in Ottawa, one of them in British Columbia. So a pretty loathsome story. There's a bit of an outcry. There's a feeling that a Newsmaker of the Year is some kind of honor, and that why are we drawing attention to this guy? The reply from the Canadian Press is that it's a news judgment issue. What was the person at the center of the big news story of the year? And that's who it was. The other controversy involves the public selection. So Ipsos Reid, which is a polling company, polled Canadians about who they thought was the big newsmaker of the year, or the top person of the year. And they picked Justin Bieber.
There you go.
He beat out the prime minister. So, we do this from time to time on the show, from the sublime to the ridiculous. I'll let you pick which is on these stories is the ridiculous, which is the sublime. But the Canadian Press is under a lot of fire, including from some politicians, to somehow or other name somebody else as Newsmaker of the Year other than an accused murderer. And the Canadian Press is sticking with its decision that it is not, you know, it's not a popularity contest. It's what was the big story of the year. And that story got an awful lot of publicity, particularly in eastern Canada, the cases in Quebec, but even here in British Columbia, because, as I said, some of the body parts turned up here. I mean, it's a gruesome story. It's loathsome. Nobody doubts that. But that was the big story of the year, according to our news editors.
Well, Vaughn, the Time magazine often points out that sometimes they pick a person or something of the year, and they've picked Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, they picked Ayatollah Khomeini, yeah. And I think they picked Hitler one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What would be your big story of the year for either BC or for Canada?
I think in British Columbia, the big story of the year was the furor over the Enbridge pipeline. When the year started, this was not a major project on the radar screen. There was certainly public concern about it. The proposal to put a big oil pipeline through northern British Columbia, much of it through pristine wilderness, to transport the heavy crude oil, bitumen, from Alberta to Kitimat and then put it on tankers and ship it around the world, became a huge story this year. There were public hearings going on, and those public hearings became the focus of protests. Native Canadians, a large number of Native First Nations, opposed the project. It became a dividing issue here in British Columbia. Our Premier Christy Clark started the year kind of trying to maintain a poise of neutrality about the project. As the year went on, she had to take a stronger and stronger position on it, raising questions, objections, making demands. The hearings themselves became a focus of protests. And as the year ends and the hearings continue into the new year, the decision of the national regulator hasn't been made on this pipeline yet, but I would say the pipeline is dead on its feet. I don't think it's ever going to be approved. And even if the regulator approves it, I don't think they could ever get it built because of the opposition.
You know, it's interesting to look at what other people say about top stories. And I was curious. I saw Environment Canada said the top story was the incredible weather that Canada has had, the devastating weather. I was wondering if overall something like Enbridge for you or the weather is climate change percolating in the background of top stories for people?
Yeah, I think it is. I think because of the obvious and increasingly obvious impact of climate change, particularly on northern Canada. I mean, most Canadians live close to the border, but the country as a whole is quite aware of this, what's happening in northern Canada. And, you know, there's some of the strongest global evidence of global warming is in the northern ice sheets and the likelihood that the northern sea passages are open much longer the year, polar ice cap melting, the permafrost line moving northward. All of that adds up to, I think, a Canadian awareness that we're one of the places in the world that is seeing increasing evidence of global warming.
Vaughn, I thought you were going to tell me that the top story of the year in Canada was the NHL strike, the hockey strike.
That's fascinating, you know. The NHL on strike again. They haven't canceled the season yet, although they're expected to do so in January if they don't cut a deal very soon. I think Canadians are really fed up. There's no love for the players or the league. If the season is, quote, saved, if the teams come back and the game resumes, people will watch it. But I think at the moment there's a profound contempt in the land for the league, the players. They're just their inability to reach any kind of agreement on it. You know, it's been joked that it's the billionaires versus the millionaires, the billionaires being the owners and the millionaires being the players. But I think they've actually hurt the affection that Canadians have for professional hockey. You're seeing there's the best proposal at the moment is that they take the trophy away from the league and award it to a junior or an amateur team this year. If the league can't get its act together, that the Stanley Cup essentially be awarded to a junior or a non-professional team in Canada. Someone said maybe the midget team should be allowed to win the or the, you know, the little kids should be allowed to win it, because their sense of the spirit of hockey is better than the league at the moment. So it's pretty interesting to watch. I would have thought it would have been a bigger story, but in a way, it's just like Canadians are fed up with the National Hockey League at the moment.
CFL, here we come. Or else, as you say, hockey from colleges. Or you never know, baseball?
Baseball.
Soccer?
I don't know. There's some soccer. Canadian Football League, great following this year. It was its 100th anniversary, and Toronto, the center of the universe for Canadians, won the trophy, so that got a lot of attention. But, I assume people are watching American sports, as they often do anyway. Hockey, I think they've overdone it this time. We had a couple of disputes already, but I think this time it's not so much anger, it's just contempt for the league, the players, and the league together.
All right, one other story real quick here. I was looking at doing some research, and so according to that Ipsos poll, the top political story of the year was the Harper government's budget of 2012. Why would that be? Because it was so austere?
I think mostly because of the way the government handled it. The Canadian government, the Harper government, has been using the fact that it now has a majority of seats in the Canadian Parliament to steamroll giant package legislation through Parliament, and it has caused some controversy. It's not so much the content of the budget, although the content is an issue. It's a little like, that in the American Congress they will sometimes add riders to bills when they put them through, and you have to vote for the whole thing as a package, and you end up having to vote for some stuff you don't like. Here, our budget debates have tended not to be handled that way. They've tended to be, they'll put through one thing under this subject and one thing under that subject. But no, the Harper government has been controversial for the way they're handling this issue. It's the biggest political story, partly because there haven't been other big political stories nationally. There's been some big stories at the provincial level. The separatists are back in power in Quebec, a surprise show in Alberta, the BC government is in serious trouble. There's been some of that, but the national government, you know, it's pretty amazing. In February of this coming year, in 2013, Stephen Harper will have been Prime Minister of Canada for 7 years. He'll be entering his eighth year as prime minister because he's selected in 2006, and he's on the verge of becoming one of our longer-serving prime ministers. So even though some people still regard him as illegitimate, and a lot of people don't like him, he's turned out to be fairly accomplished at getting power and holding it.
Interesting. All right, Vaughn Palmer's our guest. We're taking a look back on news from Canada. We'll also take a look ahead. We'll take a short break. This is Weekday on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Stay with us.
Good morning, it's 10:20. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst. Why are some people gay and other people straight? Neuroscientist Simon LeVay has been researching the science of sexual orientation. His latest book is called Gay, Straight, and the Reason Why. He sits down with KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:40.
Support for KUOW comes from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, committed to innovative thinking, scientific breakthroughs, and saving lives. Gifts and giving play an important role in supporting life-saving cancer research. Learn more about breakthroughs at fredhutch.org.
Clouds and rain, 44 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s. Same for tonight, clouds and rain, the low in the mid-30s. Cloudy again tomorrow, with just a chance of rain, tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
We're taking a look at the news of this past year from Canada with Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent at the Vancouver Sun. In about 10 minutes, we're going to take a look at the business and economic news with John Talton and Michelle Matassa-Flores, talk about what happened in the world and in our region. So, Vaughn, I noticed in just one last thing on the budget, the Harper budget, among the things that this budget did, $5.2 billion government spending cuts, eliminated 19,000 plus jobs in the public sector, and increased the age of eligibility for the Canadian pension plan to 67. Is that going to affect you, or is that something that they're gradually instituting?
They're gradually trying to take some of the pressure off the pension plans by increasing the retirement age. And other countries are dealing with it this way as well. If you start advancing the retirement age now, the actuarial statements on the pension plans will continue to stand up pretty well. Our pension plans in Canada are in reasonably good shape. They're not in some of the states of crisis that have been reported in other countries. So this is a case of, you know, the same old Canadian prudence that gave us one of the better banking systems in the world. The government has started to quietly advance the retirement age to make sure that the pension plans, that the boomers don't bankrupt the pension plan.
Yeah, well, we're seeing the same discussions down here, of course. But here the politicians keep promising, well, it won't affect you if you're on Social Security or going to be getting it in the next few years. And yet, of course, the boomers are already starting to retire.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that sort of thing, the government doing it, Canadians accept that in the long run we're going to have to do that. The more likely pressure in Canada will be on the health care system because of universal health care and an aging population. We still don't have a handle on that. What we're seeing in British Columbia is a good example because it has an older population. What we're seeing is that a larger and larger share of the provincial budget is going to health care. When I started writing about BC politics an eternity ago, back in the 1980s, the health care programs in the province were about a third of the provincial budget, and today it's approaching half of our provincial budget. So increasingly, cost of providing health care is crowding out other government programs.
You know, the other stories in this Ipsos Reid poll, XL Foods beef recall was a big story for people in 2012. Student protests in Quebec and the CNOOC takeover of the Calgary-based oil company Nexen. Those were big stories for people. What other big stories are there for you?
I think the big one here in British Columbia is one that we spent a lot of the year following and which will play out next May. and that is the next provincial election in British Columbia. The Liberal Party's been in power in British Columbia since 2001. The New Democratic Party, the party of the left, has been in opposition. Liberals have won three elections in a row. The Premier of BC was forced to step down, Gordon Campbell, but his successor, Christy Clark, is the Premier, and she's heading for an election in May, and she's trailing in the polls. The opinion polls for about a year now have pointed to the likelihood of a change of government next year. Adrian Dix, the relatively new leader of the New Democratic Party, if polls hold, will be the next Premier of British Columbia next May. But we've seen a lot of very volatile elections in Canada. We've seen a number of election results over the last couple of years where the way the polls stood at the beginning of the year wasn't the way they stood when the election was called. So I think for that reason, it ain't going to be over till it's over, but that will be the big political story in British Columbia next year, is the outcome of that election. And an awful lot of this year in BC has been given over to assessing how Christy Clark is doing, watching, you know, whether she was catching up or not. She ends the year in a better political position than she was halfway through, but she's still looking at an uphill fight to win a term of government next May.
Would Adrian Dix have profoundly different policies than Christy Clark for BC?
It's very interesting. In the past, the New Democratic Party, being a party of the left, being closely aligned to the labor movement, we've seen some wild policy swings in British Columbia when they've gone back and forth between the two parties. Dix has been very, very cautiously positioning himself as a candidate of not a candidate of major change. For example, he's ruled out most tax increases. In the past, the NDP, as I said, being a party of the left, has been associated with higher taxes. He's said that really the only tax increase that he's thinking of, and he hasn't said for sure he's going to do it, would be a surcharge, an income tax surcharge on high-income earners. So these would be people making more than $150,000 a year. He's talked about raising the corporate income tax, but by 1 point, so not back to where it was when the New Democrats left office. So he's positioning himself as a moderate. He's promising a fully detailed, fully costed election platform to be released in March before the May election. And as I say, he's tried very, very hard to say you won't have a huge swing if you change governments, that the days of wild swings are over. Well, I mean, it's a testable promise. We'll see if he gets in, but it's very unusual in our system for a leader to be laying out this much policy this far in advance, and particularly on the tax side. Usually what you get on the tax side is either very close to the election, a few tax changes, and sometimes they don't even tell you what they're planning to do till after the election, and they just spring the changes on you.
All right, Vaughn, you're going to be off for a couple of weeks. You'll have a chance to think about all this. Give me, if you have it, your feeling for 2012, your assessment of 2012 and Canada's place in it.
Oh, I think we had a pretty good year. You know, when you look around the world at the struggles, even, you know, look to our friends in the United States. The president got reelected, but he's ending the year embroiled in this terrible battle over the budget and the fiscal cliff. Canada has had a fairly good year. There's been some horrible stories, as there always are, but I would say a fairly tame year in Canada. We didn't get a lot of attention around the world, and that's probably a good thing, to be kind of ignored and overlooked.
And a lot of shopping in Blaine for milk.
Shopping. So here we are shopping. I mean, our economy is in a bit of a fragile situation. We're not ending with as much economic confidence as we had a couple of years ago. But still, as I say, considering the lot of even the European countries, we had a pretty good year.
All right, Vaughn, we'll talk to you in a few weeks. Thanks for it. Happy New Year. Happy Boxing Day. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. She joins us every Wednesday on Weekday. He'll be off for a couple of weeks. We'll talk to his colleague Les Lane about news from Canada and take a look at what's happening in the new year. And coming up, we shall talk about business and the economy for this past year with a couple of folks who spent a lot of time thinking about it. This is Weekday.
Some folks like to get away.
If you were in a room with Billy Joel and a piano,
from the neighborhood,
you'd be singing too. I'm Alec Baldwin. This week, listen as he, no, we, sing some of his songs and hear the stories behind them. Here's the thing from WNYC and PRX. It's where I find out why people do what they do.
And that comes your way Friday night at 7 o'clock. Good morning, it's 10:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from United Way of King County, thanking those who give, volunteer, and change the game for people in need at the holidays and all through the year. More at unitedwayofkingcounty.org. Live United.
We have clouds and rain, 44 degrees in Seattle's University District. Forecast calls for rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s. Same for tonight, clouds and rain, the low in the mid-30s. It's going to be cloudy again tomorrow with just a chance of rain. Tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
Hello, this is Renee Montaigne of NPR News, and we're getting to the time where we're thinking about the kinds of tax-deductible donations we make at the end of the year. And while you're thinking, put at the top of your list, KUOW. KUOW is here for you every day of the year because listeners who value public radio support it. You may have recently received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail it back with your donation or donate online at kuow.org. Thank you.
If you wear a hat, John Talton tells us, a pork pie, set it on its crown when you take it off.
Exactly.
A tip for the new year.
And I can also teach martini recipes for another day.
Because we are working on, as you know, I have posited the theory that if we all bought hats, the economy would have turned around like that.
I've done my part.
I've done my part. Michelle Matassa Flores, have you done your part to buy hats for the economy?
Not so much hats. I'm more of a shoe person.
Oh, well, shoes are good. Shoes are also going to get the economy moving again. Michelle Matassa Flores is managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Thank you for coming in today.
Glad to be
here. I'm glad you're here.
Thanks for having me.
John Talton is economics columnist for the Seattle Times. He blogs at theroguecolumnist.com, and he's author of 10 mystery and thriller novels.
10 in May.
10 in May. It's done, right?
Oh, it's done.
I'm counting it. And available at the library, also available as audiobooks.
Yes, however you buy it, you don't even have to read it. Authors just want you to buy it.
Well, fair enough. All right, I was looking at, you know, all the big stories, and then I thought, these guys are going to know it, hands down, what the big stories were of this year, right? But I will go chronologically with you. Is there a giant business or economy story that jumps out at you that says this is the one we have to be sure to talk about, Michelle? Are they all small ones?
You know, I'll go for the real person's viewpoint. I think home prices turning upward finally is a huge thing.
And that is a real person's viewpoint, yeah. Seattle's part of that, and so is your hometown of Phoenix.
Well, Phoenix is in a depression, and so...
I read today that they...
Yeah, that's their propaganda. I think the biggest macro story is this... really unprecedented in modern American history, two-track, whatever you want to call it, is that we're on. And it's evident in Phoenix, but it's evident elsewhere too, where the rich have gotten much richer. The people who have jobs are doing okay. The companies have banked more profits as a percentage of GNP than at any time in history. They have tons of cash on hand. And then on the other track, you have this growing, permanent, unemployed class of very capable people. You have young people who have enormous student loans who are getting out. They're getting jobs that pay less than the jobs I got when I got out of college. They have much more debt than I ever had when I got out of college. They may never catch up. And we have this two-trackedness going on throughout the economy that kind of overshadows and informs everything.
You know, we talked a little bit about macro and micro views. You're saying that you weren't going to do the macro, but you're thinking about the micro a lot. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if what John Talton's saying, is that been evidenced in the reporting that your reporters have done or that you've done in terms of that the cohort of the older, I'm going to stick with the older for a minute, the older worker who is underemployed, is not finding work, and has either dropped out of the workforce or is working at a much lower level. Are you finding that sort of taking root this year?
The time when I felt that the most was actually early in the year during the Occupy protests and May Day and all of that bifurcation really came through. And I was writing a little bit about that then. I was telling John, I edit mostly now, so I'm not as in touch kind of in a direct way with these stories. But at that time, I was writing a little bit. And the people who wrote to me, it was striking to me, the perspectives I heard and the anger that came out. And in Seattle, some of the business executives who you might expect to be angry with the protesters were actually supporting them until kind of they strayed from they went head to head against the longshoremen and the labor unions, and they kind of lost their support. Anyway, I think that what John's talking about came through really loud and clear then.
Do you think the Occupy story deserves to be a big story of this year because maybe it pointed out that two-track you're talking about?
Huh?
I know it's very
or
quietude
as they
is
in the South, huh? Do what? I think Occupy was useless and counterproductive. It turned into this camp out where they were, first of all, they were downtown, which is the representative of the commons. You know, they didn't march out to, what is it, Hunts Point? They didn't march out to the rich subdivisions and gated properties where the rich people live. They decided to disrupt the bus service for the poor working stiffs. Occupy had no effect at all, certainly not the effect of the Tea Party. The Tea Party's taken over legislatures all over the country. What legislature has Occupy taken over? Now, the problem of inequality is huge. It's holding back the American economy. It's going to be toxic to our democracy. But Occupy was a failure.
Hmm. You want to back them up?
I do back that up. I think I had, well, I started to say I think I had hope in the beginning. Even at that time, I was saying, well, hope toward what? I mean, what is the end game here? And I don't think they ever really had one. I think then it completely dissolved, and fairly quickly. With what I mentioned with the losing the labor support and then turning violent in the May Day protests, even though those weren't – the Occupy people say it wasn't them. It was all lumped together. I think it's a blip, unfortunately, because they raised some important issues.
But as you say, they didn't take over any legislatures.
That's where it counts.
I will say this. I don't think you can completely discount their impact on what became a very important theme in the presidential election. I'm not giving them credit for reelecting Obama, but I think the whole, you know, the 47% comment by Romney, I think there were that whole issue was more top of mind for people in part because of those Occupy protests, not necessarily in Seattle, but the Wall Street.
Now we will see if Obama sells us out. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there was one economic issue that this election was about, it was about preserving and enhancing the middle class, having the wealthy pay a little bit more, doing some nation building at home. Obama has cut short his Hawaiian vacation, even though he's not really from Hawaii, to come home.
Where is he from?
Isn't he from Kenya?
That's right. I'm just trying to – I want to make sure I'm with the joke on that.
but he has now come back to Washington to work on a compromise. He doesn't need to compromise. The election settled that.
Do you think if he goes for $400,000 as the tax, as the line where the tax cuts are maintained or cut, that's a sellout?
Yeah, I think that's a sellout. And if he starts tinkering with Social Security, where we do not have a problem, or Medicare immediately, where we have a long-term problem, but it is not because of us baby boomers. It is because of a for-profit healthcare system.
All right, let me circle back around to unemployment by going, though, John Talton and Michelle Montesa Flores, by way of what Vaughn Palmer just talked about. In Canada, they're creeping up the retirement age for the Canadian pension plan to 67. That in Medicare and in Social Security, they're talking about doing that here even faster than they're planning on doing it. But not asking the people who are currently going to be drawing down their checks, the baby boomers who are retiring now, to make a contribution. Is that the way to go?
No, it's not the way to go. I mean, we're the richest country in the history of the world.
To make a larger contribution, I should say, to be accurate. Go ahead.
And we need to maintain the social compact and the social safety net. If you want to raise the Medicare eligibility rate, then that disproportionately hurts the poor who don't live as long as the rich people. And if you want to raise that rate and make the boomers work longer, that's fine. But then you have to have jobs for the boomers. You have to have jobs for older people. And we don't have that now. One of the dirty little secrets of this recovery is that discrimination against older people is rife, and there's only so many Walmart greeters.
I was going to mention the same job opening.
I think we're both going for that one. And just a very quick thing on Medicare. And if you raise the Medicare eligibility rate age, then people put off treatments. They don't go to doctors. They can't buy insurance at that age. And so if they don't die, which is apparently the health care plan of some, then by the time they are Medicare eligible, their costs are so much higher because they've put off those treatments.
Are you seeing that concern about who's going to pay for Social Security, Medicare, in the reporting that the people that your reporters are talking to around Puget Sound?
Well, you know, I'm not sure we've picked up on that in the stories we've done at the Business Journal. I've picked up on that personally. And as I get older and my circle of friends is aging, it's certainly there among them. I remember at the unemployment offices back in early 2009, the number of older people and formerly white collar, some even executive level workers who are now unemployed and really had little hope of finding anything. And the discrimination, I think, is for real. And, you know, I think there's little hope among those people.
One of the aspects of the fiscal cliff negotiation is whether to extend the unemployment for the people who have been on long-term unemployment benefits even further. I don't know where that's going to come out in the negotiations. And I think we have just a few days, right, for that. That is going to be a real impact.
Well, I think that's on the table, and that's unfortunate. But our bigger problem is we've got to get this economy growing. We do not have an immediate debt problem. I mean, our borrowing costs are at historic lows. Everybody wants to borrow on treasuries. They want to lend us money. But we're not doing the things such as infrastructure that would goose the employment situation. We've got to have jobs. We've got an unemployment crisis. One of the dirty secrets in Washington State is that the broadest measure of unemployment, U6, that the Labor Department uses, Washington State has among the highest in the country. Now, the states with high U6 are not they're all over the map. You know, South Carolina has a very high U6. They're very low taxes, light regulation. Washington State, the People's Republic of Puget Sound, we have a high U6.
Why?
You know,
I'll ask both of you that.
I would be interested in Michelle's take. I have a theory, and that is simply that we have a very high-quality, high-technology, high-cost economy in much of Washington State. And then on the other side of the Cascades, we have an agricultural economy, which tends to have high unemployment in many seasons. And you put those two together, and you've got either unemployable or unemployed people as a combination of the two. But partly it's a mystery.
Hmm. What do you think?
It is a little mysterious, I think. I do believe a lot of the people who lost their jobs here, you know, we had the banking meltdown, manufacturing cuts. I think they're in high-skilled and high-paying fields, and the competition is really great. With the tech jobs competition is really great. I think we have a high number of people. The U6 is all about people who have given up looking for work or who are underemployed. Seattle is also a place people don't like to leave, I think. So they'll stick around even if they are without a job or underemployed rather than moving to take some low-paid job somewhere else. That might be a factor.
But so I was wondering if that was a factor.
Yeah.
We have so much less churn here than, say, they have in Phoenix. You know, Phoenix adds a lot of people every year, but what most people don't know is that it subtracts almost as many. People move in, people move out. People come to the Northwest, and I think this is true of Portland, too, which has high unemployment, and they don't want to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And our losses were huge. Washington Mutual, Weyerhaeuser did huge cutbacks and became this entire different entity. And in all these cases, you have very high-skilled people who are perhaps at a certain age where it's very difficult for them to get work.
We're talking about some of the big business trends and stories of economic stories of 2012. And if you know, we're talking about the underemployed. If that's you, if you have a thought about what the economy was doing this year and how it affected you, send us a few of your stories. Email us weekday@kow.org. I'd like to, as you said, the real people aspect of this. It's not all theory, of course. We're all affected by these economic changes. So weekday@kow.org, sort of your reaction to what the economy was doing for you or to you this year. So I was looking at some of the top business story sites. For a lot of assessment, in 2012, the 17 big banks, including Bank of America, agreed to pay $25 billion to settle allegations by the state and federal officials that they falsified documents to evict homeowners facing foreclosure. Deal represented the largest industry settlement with the government since 1998, agreement with tobacco companies. I believe you have poo-pooed that agreement.
This is a slap on the wrist.
$25 billion.
This is a slap on the wrist for companies that make trillions. The rule of law has not been applied to the banksters who brought on the Great Recession. It is a shameful episode in American history. It is one that will continue to dog us, and we are left with what economists call moral hazard, so that the banksters, and not every banker is a bankster, know that Uncle Sam, that means you, listener out there, and your tax dollars, will save them. The New York Stock Exchange was just sold. And the reason it was because there's just less money to be made in actually selling and buying stocks to assemble capital to create productive enterprises that employ people. Where the money is in derivatives, essentially gambling. It's as if I gave Michelle not a dollar. I'm holding the dollar. I gave her a piece of paper whose value is derived from the dollar. So she writes another piece of paper, gives it to Steve, and it's a derivative. It has an actual value on a market. I hold the dollar. What you guys have is nothing. If a market melts down, you're lost. But we've got $600 trillion in derivatives out there. That's what's driving the New York Stock Exchange. That's what these banks are gambling in. These are the things that helped bring on the Great Recession, and there were no criminal prosecutions at all of these CEOs, no clawbacks. It's a shameful episode.
Can you top that?
I cannot, and one reason I just love John Talton is he says it like it is. I'm not a columnist. I'm in straight-on journalism and wouldn't go around calling people gangsters or gangster, excuse me.
All right. But did you think that Rob McKenna touted that $25 billion settlement. That was one of the things he was involved in. Did you see any positive out of that in terms of the reporting that
you saw
done?
I tend to look at all of these major class action settlements, whether it's foreclosures or a bank fee, or I'm trying to think of a different industry, a prescription drug thing. It's chump change usually. It's not only chump change to the companies, it's chump change to the people who get any payout because it's spread so thin. The lawyers are the only winners in those things.
As we often hear. All right, so some of the other big stories I read, Facebook's IPO, that it was disappointing for some. I'm going to circle back around to the stock exchange towards the end here. The Dow plummeting in June. The U.S. drought may have cost the economy $150 billion. Apple became the world's most valuable company in 2012, and Hurricane Sandy devastated the East Coast, which takes us back to Uncle Sam as a whole.
And climate change.
And, mm-hmm. And yes, and climate change and its costs. What were big stories, Washington State, Puget Sound, that you were tracking, Michelle?
Amazon.com, which is changing literally the face of downtown and the northern edge of downtown. The company and its financials are fascinating. Its social values or lack of them, some people believe, are a great subject of debate around here and discussion. But there's no denying the company's on a roll in terms of hiring. It's single-handedly propping up a lot of our job market here, along with other tech companies, but it's a big driver there.
Go ahead.
Well, it and Microsoft, I was going to say. In spite of all the questions about Microsoft, they're still hiring like crazy.
Is Amazon hiring old and young? I mean, are they getting a broad spectrum of workers, do you know?
That I can tell.
Mostly younger workers.
Yeah.
And you said it's interesting, it's business and its labor practices are interesting, in part because they're a little unclear, right?
Right. They don't Seattle Times everything. Had a great series. I'll tip my hat to them, even though they're a competitor, earlier in the year about Amazon's practices. And it is it's pretty notable when you look at, you know, even Bezos, Jeff Bezos himself, and what he chooses to do or not do in terms of getting involved in the local community. We just had a feature about three younger tech executives and the amount of mentoring they do. These are the guys who started Zillow and the guy who started Avvo. They all came out of Expedia. They're very involved in mentoring young people and doing the startup weekends in the tech community. And that's it's kind of a new ethos, I think, in the tech world, which is good to see. It's interesting.
You know, I just you mentioned Bezos. You look at Gates. You look at Allen. They kind of dominate our, if not the entire economy, they dominate our business culture in a way because they've shaped the cities and the region in such a way?
Seattle is very different from a lot of American cities today in that it has a genius for reinvention that is built upon civic stewards who reinvest in the community. Paul Allen is the biggest example of that. I don't know why people dislike the guy. You know, he could have taken his billions and put them into suburban sprawl outside of Tulsa. He didn't do it. Bill Gates, too. Bezos is different. And without that sense of civic stewardship, I'm glad he's putting his headquarters here. Seattle can't maintain that. I'll throw out two or three things. One is the continuing mystery of Microsoft. Lots of cash, lots of talent. Continues to stumble. It's not General Motors. I covered General Motors. General Motors was a friend of mine. Microsoft is no General Motors, but Microsoft has to get its groove back. Boeing, the 787 started moving along. Now there's some new problems. We got the 737 MAX, and it's going to be here, and that's good. The SPIA talks in January are going to heat up, and we have one of the world's great aerospace clusters. We cannot take anything for granted because we're competing against the world. And then finally, the port competition between Seattle and Tacoma is not good for either of us because the Pacific Northwest continues to lose overall market share at a time when the Panama Canal is going to be wider, when the Canadian government and the railroad have spent a ton of money to develop the Prince Rupert Container Port. And so we need to find a way to have the ports work together more constructively. The deeper problem is that Pierce County is ailing. They have Joint Base Lewis-McChord. They have the Port of Tacoma, which they lavishly support in a way that Seattle taxpayers are unwilling to support the seaport in Seattle. But Pierce County has lost, they lost Weyerhaeuser, they lost Russell. We need to have a broader conversation about ways to enhance the Pierce County economy, especially in terms of quality and better wages. so that there's not this blood sport of the Port of Tacoma, which can always underbid the Port of Seattle, although Seattle did keep Hanjin. And those are competitive things we're going to need to watch in the new year and beyond.
Do you see any opportunity for – do you look at Pierce County too, Michelle? Do you see any opportunity there, you know, where the growth is there?
I'm not very optimistic about it. I think it's important, and John's right. But regional cooperation is not a strong suit around here for all of our images. You know, nice, being nice Seattle people don't really want to join arms.
Is all the growth taking place in King County? I mean, is Snohomish getting some of that high-tech growth?
Not much. I mean, the interesting thing is that there is a reset toward high-quality urbanism, toward downtowns and walkable city neighborhoods and places with abundant transit, and that is the city of Seattle. That's not to say that there aren't good things happening anywhere else, but the old sprawl model is pretty much dead. People aren't moving as much. Young people want cities. And you look at downtown Seattle smartly stepping over the loss of WAMU and the Great Recession.
But why isn't Everett or Tacoma attracting that second-tier growth? They have good housing stock. They still have old buildings. Downtown Tacoma is always trying to reinvent itself. It lacks an economic driver. Is that
right? This is just a gut feeling, but with so much of the growth coming from the tech sector, I think a lot of those are young workers. They're kind of this weird crossover between geek and hipster. I don't know where that happens, but they like the downtown living. You know, Bellevue is booming. Downtown Bellevue is booming, which is kind of cool, but I don't see that happening. You know, Everett's getting some good spinoff out of the Boeing growth, obviously, but otherwise I don't see it happening either.
And the Boeing workers drive. You know, they live all over the Sound. One of the interesting things is that the new workable paradigm is the urban tech campus that you see with Amazon and with the biotech companies, where people mingle. Richard Florida calls it creative friction, that you just don't get with getting in a car, driving 20 miles to the old-fashioned office, quote-unquote, park. And so you're seeing this growth cluster in places like Seattle and Chicago and Boston.
You know, you mentioned biotech, and Leroy Hood was just honored for his efforts in biotech and his business efforts in biotech. You see that? That was sort of, it seemed a bit quiet in 2012. Is there changes coming in 2013? Do you know?
If there are, I think
they're still quiet.
They haven't been revealed yet. It is, you know, just, it seems like every time biotech seems like it's going to gain some traction, then it slips back down the hill. And there's another big merger and layoffs. So I don't know.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the South Lake Union and Paul Allen, but I was wondering, what would South Lake Union be like if Amazon hadn't gone down there and it was still relying on the biotech industry and the life sciences to be the growth engine?
Well, it would be, as I think Ron Judd said, it would be the place where bowling trophy stores are.
I like that store. That's one of my favorite stores. All right. We'll leave it there on a sort of a note about what happens to the underemployed. Really, that's what I'm taking away from this conversation and where they go. Michelle Matassa Flores is managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you'll come again.
Thank you.
And John Talton is economics columnist for the Seattle Times and the author of 10 mystery and thriller novels.
Thanks, Steve.
And thank you for listening. We'll have a special on the Clean Air Act tomorrow. We're also going to ask you to think about your regrets for 2012, so think about that. And on Friday, our annual The Song That Sings the Year. What was the song, the piece of music, the ditty that defined 2012 for you personally, or 2012 in politics and economics and social issues? Think about that. We'll take that up on Friday. Have a good day.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away.
Support for KUOW comes from the Bush School, where students are challenged to reach beyond the conventional expectations of learning to use their education to make a difference in the world. K-12 open house in January. More information at bush.edu.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Andy Hurst.
When vegan activist Kathy Freston gave up animal products, the key was to do it gradually.
I'm not a gal who likes anything strict or disciplined. I grew up in Doraville, Georgia, and I ate barbecued ribs and chicken fried steak, cheesy grits.
I'm Renee Montaigne, leaning